Well, I'll be back in Los Angeles on Friday bringing you Open Lines. And I do believe we may have Elvira for you on our first hour. That's kind of neat. You know, Vampira just passed away just several weeks ago. We'll be back in a moment with Charles Ossman on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Charles Ossman. Charles, let's get into the science now of what's going on out there. Let's pick it up by starting, first of all, with nanotechnology. Sure. I think it might have been you who taught me years ago about nanotechnology, because honestly, I had never heard of it before.
Well, okay, and it's interesting because actually it goes back 50 years. Richard Feynman, a very famous physicist who's passed away, Nobel Prize laureate back in the 50s, he actually made a very famous statement once. He said, there's a lot of room at the bottom, and that was kind of the inspiring start point of a lot of folks in the material science world who said, he's got a point there. If we could figure out a way to get down to the intramolecular and even intra-atomic levels of interaction and manipulate matter in a precise way to accommodate whatever we're trying to engineer or create, that opens up a gigantic Pandora's box of possibilities. And the reason it does is because in traditional manufacturing, whether it's through chemistry or through what's called top-down manufacturing, like manufacturing computer chips and things like this, you have to go through an unbelievably complicated and very expensive and very resource-consuming way to either get the chemistries to combine and form a new compound or to chemically mill a chip surface to get the features you're looking for, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And the objective was to get around these huge centralized industrial sites and or foundries and be able to sort of grow things from the bottom up. That was the real start point. And then material science types began to look at, well, how do we actually do this? What ways can we manipulate atoms and molecules to align themselves or to patch themselves together or to assemble in some way that can make something that we could control, that is, we could dictate precisely what kind of a pattern they would form or what kind of a structure they would make, et cetera, et cetera. So going back maybe 30 years or so, the first inklings of this concept came to light, and it was, you know, very obscure and kind of labeled, sort of like niche science, as it were. And then, of course, somebody named Eric Drexler came along and founded something called the Forsyth Institute, of which I was a member back in the early 90s. And a lot of folks came out of the woodwork with their different ideas, some of them pretty radical, some of them very radical, and a lot of them, much more like traditional science, but shaped to this new agenda. So over the past 10, 12 years, as the investment community began to see some light at the end of the tunnel, because investors don't like to invest in science because it has too long of an ROI, a return on investment. But when they begin to see actual products or manufacturing processes or what you might call fundamental technologies, which would shape the industries they're already invested in, could be changed by this process, then they became interested. So once that started to happen and the investment dollars started coming in, then all of a sudden you went from essentially, you know, zero, except for a few scientists, to like overnight, countries all over the world were getting very much involved. And I was actually part of some of the earlier committees and people that would have these discussions. And there's something called the NNI, or National Nanotechnology Initiative, headed by Mihail Rocco, who I've met any number of times. And Mihail Rocco is a very interesting guy because he kind of got it right in the very beginning. He said, nanotechnology is not going to be a single science. It's really going to be a mix of a whole variety of different sciences coming from chemistry, biology, physics, different kinds of engineering, et cetera, who are going to have to, in some way, figure out a way to merge together. And this really forced a new kind of paradigm in academia where you had originally had these very isolated, very separate kind of domains of science that were kind of like little empires into themselves. And this was the first time, really, on such a large scale that an agenda was set forth to say that we have to change these rules. We have to make it much more interactive, much more dynamic, and really have much more of a collaborative approach to how to make this sort of industrial paradigm come to play. So in a way, it wasn't just a technology. It was also a social slash almost like an academic paradigm at the same time. And that was really what made it come to pass in a much quicker fashion.
When these companies were being put together, these nanotech companies specifically, did they have a goal, a mission?
In many cases, they started as materials companies. In other words, they had a very interesting set of molecules that they could say, look at this, we can make these little tetrapods or these little spheroids or these little cubes or whatever it is, and they can line up or create layers or whatever it is. And then other folks from different industries who are looking for ways to manufacture their products would say, okay, show us more. And as they would develop the technique and ramp up so they could produce these materials on a larger scale, then the other industries would step forward and say, okay, I think now we're at a point where you can actually begin to incorporate these new materials processes into our existing manufacturing systems and sort of make a switch over. And you see this already in many areas. In specialized materials that are used in cars now, they're used in electronics, it's used in... it's kind of... I'll put it like this. When people buy a computer, a typical PC, they see a little word that says Intel inside. But most people don't really care it's Intel. They just care that it's a computer and you turn it on and it works. So in a way, it's the same thing with nano. You'll see nanotech is showing up in all kinds of products. It doesn't say nano inside, but in fact, if you were to unravel the manufacturing process or the materials, you would find some aspect of nanotechnology woven into how it made the new thing possible.
Now, when these technologies are applied, at what point do you think we are on that, on the totem pole of nanotechnology?
Well, initially...
Let's say 5 years ago, we were at 2%, let's say.
Sure.
Where are we now?
Well, worldwide, it's a $500 billion industry, and it's moving very quickly. So how we compare to places like India, China, and Russia, for instance, is a good question. China, by the way, has the largest percentage per capita of published papers on different developments in the nanotech arena than any other country in the world, although we're certainly holding our own in that context. But the thing that I sense, or the thing that I'm kind of concerned about, is that we have spectacular capacity for inventing things here. And I see this every day. In the terms of what's called due diligence, I go to labs, I look at things, I evaluate their technical aspects in terms of commercial viability, and I look at a lot of stuff, and it's interesting. But often, the things that get invented here end up getting replicated somewhere else, and that's the thing we're sort of trying to keep a handle on. And in a way, I think that as the shift goes from large, centralized, top-down industry systems to much more localized, granular industry systems, the challenge isn't just the technology, it's how to actually manage that kind of a new business model. That may be part of the puzzle that's still being sort of worked on as we speak. I'll give you an example. Well, let me start with something that's kind of interesting. One of the big problems that's facing the world is the toxic leftovers of a lot of our traditional products, be they computers, appliances, all sorts of things. And the leftovers of these things end up in these hideous, horrible sludge ponds and sort of toxic waste sites, most of which are not here. They're abroad. They're usually in Africa, parts of Asia, anywhere where the local government in question is very hungry, very economically disadvantaged. And so large Western interests can sort of come in and say, for a fee or for whatever the thing is, we just need a chunk of land over here so we can dump all this stuff, and that doesn't happen. I mean, we're going to
pollute you, not us.
Thank you. And China, by the way, is a big player in this. I mean, I'm not trying to say that we're the bad guys. I mean, everybody's got a certain amount of guilt in this. So in a practical sense, how do we unravel this? Well, there's something called bioremediation. This is something I'm really excited about, because what this is, these are sort of organisms that have been genetically modified to be able to metabolize these things that are in these sludge ponds or these waste pits. The point being that you have a lot of metals, you have a lot of other materials, which while they're in the solution in the pond or in the sludge pile, they're almost impossible to get out, or they're so expensive to get out that it's not really worth the effort. On the other hand, if one can sprinkle in these modified microbes or these modified biological agents that will on their own metabolize the materials in question and then can be harvested, now all of a sudden you turn a huge, hideous toxic waste site into an actual recovery site that can not only be neutralized in terms of its toxicity, but you can actually harvest those materials and turn a profit. That's a really big deal, and that's like a really major piece of this larger puzzle. So as companies begin to realize that not only is the manufacturing of their products possibly made cheaper and less polluting, but the end results of their previous products can in fact be recovered and get a recycling sort of loop established, that's, I think, a very major point to be considered in some systems.
And now let's talk about space as this is applied to. Why is space so important to this?
Oh, gosh. Well, this can go in many different directions. But I think the near term is that in the sense of being able to harvest energy and beam it back down to Earth, that's like a really big first step. But there's a lot of reasons why microgravity or zero gravity is extremely advantageous for creating things that would be possible here on Earth, but at a much greater expense or complexity. And even though when the space lab was first put together, and I was kind of halfway supporting it to a certain degree, although sadly it's turned into sort of a boondoggle in a way, but the theory was to encourage various countries to contribute their piece of the puzzle, build this lab, and then invite private industry to sort of go up there and try their hand at doing various things. Well, for a lot of complicated reasons, many of which are political, that sort of never really quite took off. But people have not lost interest in the concept. If there was a way to commercialize space so that you can send your payloads up and bring them back down at a relatively low cost and do so on a frequent basis, like we have air traffic now, only this would be like space travel, as we're, you know, suborbital craft going back and forth, then all of a sudden you have a whole panorama of different kinds of materials, many of them medical, by the way, that could be manufactured that simply would not be possible on Earth, and much more importantly, could be done with a much less impactful footprint, both in terms of resource consumption and toxicity as they're left as the remnants of this manufacturing process. So establishing a kind of an industrial system, as it were, in microgravity environment, there's an enormous set of reasons why that kind of plays into future industrial paradigms, because we realize that as we are here on Earth, for instance, I'll give you an example. To manufacture, say, silicon solar cells is an unbelievably demanding process. It consumes a huge amount of water. It's a very it takes a lot of energy to actually make the cells in the first place, et cetera. There's new materials coming out, though, which can be grown, like thin films, and they can be put onto laminates and printed on a surface, almost like printing ink and some now you're printing chemistries. Well, you can take that a step further. If you could do that kind of thing in space, it takes even less impact in terms of energy consumption and so forth. And in fact, it's like orders of magnitude difference. So you can pick any variety of different kinds of things you're looking for in terms of an industry, but if you can eventually get to the point where you can do it there instead of here, you win in many different directions at the same time.
All right. Shuttle technically goes offline when? 2010?
2010. And this is a really, really, really bad thing because the Russians and the Chinese and the Indians are all building low-cost, high-yield, high-payload capacity delivery vehicles. That's what they're going for. And in fact, I think it was Bob Bigelow who made this statement a while ago. He's the person, of course, who did the inflatable space station.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I give him all the credit in the world. This is a
he's got a couple pods up there now.
Exactly
he?
Right. And I mean, this is the true American spirit. Here's a guy who made his money off of real estate and various investments, and he got to a certain point and said, "You know what? I see this as the next new thing." And he, you know, kind of a maverick ahead of his time, but he got it right. And he said, "Look, I'm not going to build gigantically complex big systems. I'm going to build things that use existing materials, inflatables, things that can be, you know, delivered with relatively low cost." And what's kind of funny is NASA has been sort of, I don't want to say disinterested, but sort of not really paying attention to this kind of mindset. And in fact, when some of the first private sort of space tours went to Russia, went to orbit, they almost ignored them. It was like they didn't exist. It's a really strange, and I'm saying this kind of carefully because, as I said earlier, there's a lot of people in NASA that I have great respect for as people, as scientists, as technical folks. They're excellent people, but I think that they're confined in a sort of an odd, culture / political situation, which is not of their making.
It's a new NASA, Charles,
it's
as
a new
you
NASA.
And
yes.
Richard Hoagland know.
Exactly right. And so you have people like Richard Branson and others who are, you know, launching their privately funded spacecraft and suborbital flying systems and so forth, and they see this. They understand exactly what's going on. So this is their attempt to sort of match this rapidly moving agenda. But elsewhere in the world, they are already looking at how to deliver lots of material in fairly short order with relatively low cost, with interchangeable components and, you know, expendable rockets, that kind of thing. So, I mean, while we're going to be actually out of the loop for several years, that's when they're going to start their own programs delivering things into space. And so whoever has the delivery capacity, this is what Bob Bigelow was saying, whoever can sort of corner the delivery market, as it were, they're going to be the ones that are going to sort of own that sector for the years to come.
Why in God's name do we continue then to pump so much money into Iraq when we are leaving these things to dry?
I wish I had an answer for you, George.
It is absolutely incredible.
It's insanity. And yet you almost have to kind of go to these kind of conspiratorial views because otherwise there's no logic at all. It just does not make sense. And, you know, two things play into my mind, and this, again, will be a little controversial, but what the heck. I think that here in this country, when the Republicans decided they wanted to, you know, sort of take the reins of control, they made a play to the religious far right. I'm not sure how to word this in a pleasant way, but they went to the fundamentalist sort of voting bloc and said, "We'll sing your song. You know, we'll make sure that everything looks, you know, evangelical from your perspective. Just give us the vote and we'll make everything happen." So given that kind of a context, they were faced with some really strange challenges because they had to deliver a kind of a policy that looked favorable to the evangelical world. And that, in a strange way, has forced us somewhat to get into this sort of us versus the evil Islamist, you know, kind of mindset. Not that there aren't some bad players in the picture. I'm just saying it kind of amplified that interest. And also, this is where it may get even more tricky, there's a big controversy right now about is there actually life out there or not. And I'm going to submit to you that life is absurdly common. It's as common as beach sand. And speaking of Sir Charles Schulz once again, for those that have visited his website, and I have some of his pictures on the site now, there are fossils on Mars. There are things that look just like living things that have been there sometime in the past.
Yes.
In fact, it's kind of obvious. And I have talked to people privately who said, oh, yeah, we know this stuff. There, of course it is. It's craziness to not say this. But they are confined. They cannot say what they would wish to say because of the strange political climate. And I'll give you one small example. But this really happened. I was there. I saw it. So what can I say? I was at JPL about 2.5-3 years ago. A friend of mine who does this sort of technical sort of business forum, they have at JPL once in a while, I was one of the invited guests. So I was there. And after we gave my little talk and everything, I was sitting right next to the director of JPL, and here's this lady and her husband, who's a very religious fellow and also happens to be a senior financial advisor to the Bush administration. It's a long story. But anyway, so we're sitting there, and I was having a chat with this guy, and I said, no, look, I've been looking at some of the photographs that Sir Charles Schulz has been putting up and others have as well, and it's kind of obvious. I can see fossils. I can see things that look kind of like living structures. What's your opinion? And before this guy could even say a word, my friend's husband jumps up and says, you will not find life on Mars. And he started, like, you know, like waving in his hands and getting, you know, upset and red in the face. And this is like a very formal sort of suit and tie kind of thing. I was thinking, oh, my God, what have I done? You know, some horrible faux pas I've committed. And then his wife kind of, you know, changes subjects. They've also had lunch now or something. But, I mean, it was a weird moment where I sensed very strongly that there were people at JPL that said, yes, of course we see it. It was obvious. But, I mean, here was a guy who really represented sort of the financial side of the picture coming up with this very specific, religiously driven opinion saying, you will not find life. You know, I mean, just it was so bizarre. And I swear this happened, and I was watching this thinking, this is like Twilight Zone. I mean, I would not have believed it had I not seen it with my own eyes. And yet there is that kind of mindset where people are being told what they're allowed to say and kind of what they're not allowed, you know, allowed to say, whether it's climate research or life elsewhere or a whole variety of things, which play into this larger agenda as to, you know, how we spend our money and in what context and what kind of quasi-military slash maybe religious sort of situations that we get ourselves in. I think that's part of the picture.
Well, you know, if you look at the whole thing, then it looks like everybody is out to get us.
Well, maybe not out to get us, but they see that we've been weakened by our own internal
greed?
Greed and short-sightedness and people with their own kind of limited agendas. There is a thought that says, even, say, 10, 12 years ago, people already knew that we'd be perhaps in the downswing. So they were starting to hedge their bets by putting their investments elsewhere. And you saw a shift out of America to other parts of the world where they felt their investments would be safer. And to a certain degree, you can kind of understand this point. And once that flow started to happen, it's like water over a dam. Then others began to follow. And that, in a sense, is what led to this banking debacle, because people realized that, okay, if it's all going to start going downhill, let's make our quick bucks now and bail out before, you know, it starts really getting unfortunate. And that, I think, exacerbated the problem. It became like an acceleration vector and just kept snowballing, given this sort of impetus, as it were.
And they got caught. We'll be back, Charles. Don't go away. Well, it's starting the free StreamLink week for you. Just get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the instructions, how to do it. Those of you who are not familiar with StreamLink, you will enjoy it. It's just a fun tool to augment your radio station, your computer, and just sit back and enjoy the program. Extremely affordable as well, pennies a day. It's StreamLink, and it's yours for free for 1 week. We'll be back. Charles, where does DNA fit into all this? DNA.
Yes, my favorite topic. I was going to talk about ultralight composite materials, but I'll go to DNA because it's such a wonderful thing.
Sure.
And we'll get back to it later. DNA is so interesting because I remember 15 years ago, maybe almost 20 years ago, when the first suggestion of the biotech industry was sort of just getting off the ground. And I met a guy whose name I'm trying to remember right now, but he got his PhD for synthesizing one protein. That was his big thing. He could synthesize a protein and make it work. Okay, fine. Nowadays, we can synthesize millions of proteins at will. We can synthesize whole strands of DNA and sort of make them do interesting things. We can actually build circuits with DNA. We can grow structures with DNA. There's a whole variety of folks that are now in sort of this genetic architecture kind of thing where they can build actual machines and, you know, calculating circuits and all kinds of things, as well as actually making living organisms. And along the way, there is this bizarre discovery about something called junk DNA. And everybody's scratching their head trying to say, well, what exactly is this? And you may recall, back around the year 2000 again, when NIH, National Institute of Health, and the National Science Foundation funded their version of the Human Genome Project, with Francis Collins being its director.
Right.
And then Craig Venter, who had a company called Solera, he said, well, okay, here's the government's version. They claim it'll take 10 or 12 years and so many billions of dollars. Here's my private venture version, and we're going to do it for, you know, maybe a fraction of that in 3 years. And there was a race. And they actually went to the – I met both these guys, by the way, at the Bio 2000 conference, which was a huge event here in San Francisco with 30,000 people attending. And it was really interesting because it was almost like a blood feud, you know, the government side versus the private side. And it was interesting to watch this kind of thing unfold. And they both had their own take on what they thought the human genome was going to eventually turn out to be and how they were going to work with it to create solutions for diseases and all this kind of thing. And they were both sort of partly right and partly wrong. But what came out of this was a beautiful synthesis between these two different viewpoints and a kind of a new way of examining that maybe, you know, public-private ventures sort of collaboration might actually be the best way to go. And out of all that, when they finally unraveled the human genome, what they discovered was there's a lot of genetic material that can't explain why it's there. And this is really interesting because, as anyone will probably tell you that knows the science a little bit, nature is extremely efficient. And every nook and cranny that one looks anywhere on this planet, that even that life even has the tiniest chance of surviving, you'll find life flourishing and doing whatever it's doing.
And if you go, and nature doesn't waste anything.
Doesn't waste anything. Thank you. There's never an empty spot. I don't care what it is, there's always some parasite or some little microbe or something that's figuring out a super clever way to find a niche in whatever the thing is.
Yep, exactly.
And in fact, in the field of astrobiology, just to branch off for a second, because some of my friends at NASA are NASA astrobiologists, this is what they do. They specialize in going to various parts of the world where you would not expect to find life at all, whether it's bubbling mud pits where it's a, you know, pH of 2 at 85 degrees Celsius, or inside of a rock mm-hmm. that's half a mile down in a cave somewhere, or 40 feet down the ice in some ice core they pull up, sure enough, they find living things.
There it is. That's right.
And in fact, the most spectacular example were these deep-sea trenches, and where they found whole ecosystems flourishing about. And the reason that's kind of a big deal is because up till then, virtually every biologist, in fact, you can still find old biology textbooks that, you know, says this very clearly, it was always supposed to be a photosynthesis or a light-driven process. That is, at the very bottom of the food chain, you had to have some kind of chlorosynthesis to convert sunlight into sugars that could then be consumed and turned into fuel for the larger organisms, et cetera. So you had to have light in the equation somewhere. However, when you're, you know, 2.5 miles down in seawater, there's no light down there. But what they found were these unbelievably huge, like, you know, worms and all kinds of strange-looking creatures and things they'd never seen before. And the whole thing was a sulfur. It was a chemical-based system as opposed to a light-based system. This blew the roof off of virtually every major biology paradigm there was, because for the first time, we had found evidence of an entire different kind of life system that simply could not exist with the previous rules. Now, what this told the astrobiology folks was, you know, our interpretation of what life should be or could be or where it might be, we better change the rules, because clearly, even here on this planet, we're finding that things are not as we thought they were. So, you know, the further we go into these kinds of areas of investigation, the more we discover that we don't know, actually. And so another metaphor along the same lines is this whole idea about junk DNA. So that raises a lot of questions. And in fact, one of the graphics I put up on the screen, which I actually got from this Singularity Institute, kind of shows this transition of how we evolved and where evolutionary paths have taken us. And there's a sort of a jump between the sort of proto-humanoid ape creatures, whatever you want to call them, then all of a sudden we become modern humans. And nobody's really been able to figure out, well, how did that all happen all of a sudden? I mean, there's just this, like, instantaneous burst where all of a sudden we went from, you know, one type of creature and then suddenly became what we are now. Well, what actually happened there? What was the what was the marker that made that come true? What was the actual change of DNA, or what was the transposons who were the elements that actually caused these mutations to occur? How did that start up? What was the instigation process? Nobody has an answer. However, we have this undefinable genetic material in our DNA. Now, I'm just going to throw an idea there and take it as it were. If one wanted to walk the path that says maybe somebody else came by and maybe helped a little bit, maybe there's a little bit of genetic material that isn't exactly ours. In fact, maybe this is a pretty common thing. Now, this is going way off in a limb, and I realize this is branching out there, but I'm just going to throw it out there. Because as genetic researchers begin to probe into this, they keep coming up with yet-to-be-defined functions compared to DNA that they can't explain why it's there. And as most geneticists will tell you, their whole job is to figure out exactly what set of protein pairs translates into what function or what characteristic in the organism in question. And, of course, there's still lots of things yet to be discovered. But the fact that this stuff's even there that cannot be correlated by any standard techniques of analysis does suggest there's a kind of an open box there. And I would submit to you that, you know, the term panspermia, just to, for the audience, there's a term called panspermia. And it talks about how life spreads through the cosmos. And the usual model that astrobiology types will tell you has to do with microbes or even subproteomic units, prions and that kind of thing, coming in from space rocks or from whatever, and they land on the planet, and then they sort of form together and create what becomes the protein system for life. Other experiments, of course, going back to the mid-50s, there were experiments at the University of Illinois and then later at Caltech and et cetera, where they could take an environment of ammonia and similar materials and pump electrical currents, right, to simulate what was going on the Earth, you know, billions of years ago. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, you get peptides in the building blocks of life. So there's different ways that these proteomic subunits can sort of start. That's one model. But what if there was another model that went in parallel with this that said that, let's just say, for just the sake of argument, that there's ETs out there and they kind of cruise around, they look for things that are interesting, like we do now, only on a much larger scale, and they find a planet with some organisms on there that are kind of interesting, sort of within range of being adjustable, let's say, to something that's perhaps more functional and, you know, quasi-intelligent, et cetera. And so with just a little bit of tinkering, they can kind of, you know, poof, make that snap happen, and suddenly you have the organism in question. They know it's going to take a certain number of thousands of years for the organism to slowly evolve and eventually become social and eventually become to develop civilizations and cross certain boundary points or thresholds of technology development.
But they know it will.
Yes, it will. And it takes a certain length of time. And they come back once in a while to sort of see what happens to their experiment. And along the way, they leave a message or two here and there that gets translated in the form of, say, spiritual mythos. And the basic message is something like this. Here's some rules to live by. You know, don't kill each other. Don't do terrible things. You know, like the Ten Commandments, as it were, but sort of in different ways to express these ideas, like a spiritual maturity index of sorts.
They better come back with the rules again.
Yes, exactly right. And we're going to come back in a few thousand years, and we're going to see how well you learned these rules. And if it didn't work out, then you're probably going to...
We're going to change you. We're going to alter you.
Or you simply expunge yourselves. In other words, I think, in my humble opinion, that this may have happened, and that this rule system was presented. And what I find really fascinating is in more than 65 cultures on 5 continents, you find almost the same identical set of rules. They may be explained differently. They may have a different sort of cultural overtone. But the basic philosophy is this, that something of some spectacular significance is going to happen right about now or soon to now, in the first third of the 21st century, as we count to be in the Julian calendar. And for any number of reasons, all these different cultures went to unbelievable extremes, you know, building huge monuments. I mean, many of your guests in the past have talked about this much more than I can, and have created, you know, works of stone and astronomical calculations and so forth to such an astonishing degree and with spectacular effort. I mean, it really taxed their civilization to the absolute maximum they could possibly have done these kind of things. And you have to ask yourself, why? What could possibly motivate these groups of people from all these different areas to focus on the exact same thing, roughly around the same time, with the same agenda? That is, we have to live by these rules, and if you fail, then something bad will happen, or you'll be forced to sort of, you know, re-evolve in a different way, et cetera. You know, something sort of told them these ideas. And I'm just suggesting that if that's the case, then perhaps, just perhaps, the explanation for this mysterious so-called junk DNA, that this is the footprint of a tinkering or a modification, And instructions were left behind to say, we'll come back eventually and we'll see how you're doing. And if you sort of get it, you get to go to the next quarter. And if you don't, if you haven't gotten it, then you'll probably expunge and, you know, sort of do yourselves in. But that's the natural order of things. And it's supposed to happen that way. And a lot of people get sort of caught up in the mythos of, well, these words in this book is the only way, or this is my way is the better way than your way, you know, go to warfare and so forth. And this is kind of where it's gone so terribly wrong, because if there was that kind of spiritual wisdom being offered, and it got somehow mutated into these very narrow, brittle, rigid, political sort of documents to control populations or to justify wars and so forth, then they missed the point completely. And sadly, that's kind of what has happened here. Not in all cases, but certainly in a number of them. And so I would say that's kind of a coin flip. I mean, the coin's up in the air to see which way it's going to go. But it would be right about now, as a matter of fact, that they would come back and want to have a look to see how well did we or did we not understand that larger message.
Wouldn't it be interesting to talk with the genetic manipulators to ask them who manipulated the you?
Well, the thing is, we're not supposed to ask them. In other words, I believe firmly that if we cannot show by evidence of our own behavior that we're capable of a sort of a larger view or a holographic view, as I put it, and can understand the sort of larger spiritual maturity kind of way of looking at things, then we should not be allowed to propagate and expand outward, because in a sense, in our current form, we're still like a toxic organism. We're still, sadly, rather warlike, rather aggressive. Not everybody. I mean, I know lots of people personally who do get this and are trying really, really hard to show a better way to be. They're trying in their own special way and with groups to sort of, you know, can we do something different than what we're doing? So, I mean, across the board, around the planet, there's many different people who I think are starting to really wake up and see this. And you were mentioning this at the very beginning edge of this program. You were talking about chaos and acceleration mm-hmm. and people submitting or succumbing to sort of this sense of urgency. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's actually what's supposed to be happening right about now. And how we respond to that challenge or how we respond to that pressure is what determines if we got the lesson or not. I think some have and many have not, but it's still a work in progress.
So you feel it too then, don't you?
Yes, very much so. Yeah. And oddly enough, I didn't start by looking at monuments or looking at pyramids or anything. I started by looking at DNA. That was how I got to this point of view. So in other words, what I find kind of curious, since we were talking about DNA earlier, is that by whatever lens one wishes to view, whether it's the macro lens, looking down the planet from a distance, or walking amongst great monuments, whether it be in Machu Picchu or, you know, Egypt or wherever it might be, or if you're down to molecular level looking at DNA, you do see sort of the same possible suggestion of a pattern of sorts, that something had occurred in the past that we're not quite sure what it was, but we were changed as a byproduct of that, whatever it was, and that there was a lesson being presented, which is supposed to culminate about now. And the molecular evidence for that possibly could be in this so-called junk DNA.
And you think they put it here?
I think that we're one of many. And this is the other part that sadly is kind of frustrating. Some of the religious paradigms that we are aware of have decided to determine that we're special, that we're the only ones, that we're the image of God, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. I'm not buying that at all. But I do think that, in a sense, we were allowed to kind of flounder about and interpret amongst ourselves what we were supposed to do with the information that we were given, because that is part of the test. And I would submit to you further that probably the large majority of civilizations on planetoids sprinkle around probably don't make it. It's probably a select few that actually get past this next threshold. But we're at that threshold now. And what I find extremely fascinating, by the way, for those folks who are interested in what are called exoplanets. Exoplanets are planets that are other than here in our solar system. There's well over 200 now. If you go to a 50-light-year radius from our point here and just look out in space, there's over 200 different solar systems with planets that we can now say here they are.
That we can see.
We can actually measure and see, right. And so there's several satellites being put together as we speak, which will refine this to actually, for the first time, be able to look for Earth-sized planets, and that's in the very near future. And once again, our friends over there in Russia, China, India, I mean, that's clearly in their agenda as well. See, because I think, this is my humble opinion, I think that they are not confined, and I'm sorry if this sounds the wrong way, and I'm trying to make this sound pleasant, but they're not confined by the same religious / sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, fundamentalist kind of viewpoints that our current administration is so somehow succumbing to. They don't really see that. That's not really part of their mechanism of thought. they look at it much more practical way. They just say, okay, we see the chemistry. We can, you know, spectrographically now, we can actually look, we can actually probe the surrounding stars and the interstellar dust, and we can actually see organic compounds in that spectrographical information. It's pretty obvious. So, I mean, there's stuff out there, and we don't know exactly what it is, but we can tell there's quasi-organic stuff out there. And so, again, not just the near-term industrialization of space and possibly the weaponization of space, but also the concept of life being out there that they can sort of get a closer look at, they also, again, because they're not limited by this sort of quasi-religious, sort of fundamentalist cloak, they can proceed in a way that we actually are not right now.
You really believe that these religious ideologies are holding us back?
I think that because the current administration was so, saying this politely, willing to sort of sell themselves to get into office by whatever means necessary, that this was the quick and easy way to get in, was to sort of get the evangelical vote en masse. And in order to get to that point, they had to kind of sing their tune to stay.
I mean, is the evangelical vote, Charles, or support saying, don't go into space?
I'm saying that if we suddenly came out tomorrow and said, yes, we found life, it's everywhere, it's pretty obvious, plus we have evidence that says that life was here, intelligent life may have been here, maybe affected us, that the whole idea of what, you know, is said in the Bible versus what we can actually show by physical evidence may not actually match, it would be a serious problem. It would be a very serious problem here. Also in the world, I don't think it would matter that much at all. But here,
I think it would be a worldwide calamity.
Well, maybe or maybe not. I'm very familiar, by the way, with the Rand report that came out in the mid-50s and other reports like it. But that
And Brookings, that simply said,
we
can't handle the truth.
That was in 56, yes. And I mean, I think others back then probably would have said the same thing, and then certainly at that time it was probably true. But things have changed a lot. I can say this much, that, I mean, I live a mile from the UC Berkeley campus, and certainly for a lot of the young folks I run into on an everyday basis, for them, this is like, so what? Okay, fine, we get it. If there's other things out there other than us, let's figure it out and figure out what we should do. And, you know, I mean, it's not even a big deal. But the people who run the show, for those folks, for whatever set of reasons, they still feel confined by this larger quasi-ecclesiastic sort of theocratic kind of system that they've feel so tightly connected to, because that's how they got their power.
Well, you might be right on that, Charles Ostman. You might be right on
well,
that.
Well, I hope nobody's going to, you know, cast spells in my direction. I'm just saying that, you know, to get to a more spiritually mature perspective, it's not going to be found inside of the text of a particular version of a particular book that somebody says, you must obey this because I said so. It's going to come from our better sense of who we are as living things, and of the real values that we should be expressing to each other and to the world. And, you know, interestingly enough, I've actually met some evangelicals of the younger sort who actually are leaning in this direction. They're, believe it or not, there's actually a whole collection of folks who they're very pro-religious, but they're also pro trying to adapt to the new world. They sort of see what's coming around the corner. So there's sort of a generation gap, actually, within that social membrane or that social sort of manifold. But it's still a very difficult and brittle manifold to try to operate in.
Well, let me tell you what's coming around the corner for you, Charles Ostman. Phone calls. We're going to open them up. This is the floating format. Charles started earlier, so we'll take calls with him next on Coast to Coast AM.